Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. Five universities, a PhD, MBA and MPA, author of five best-selling books, trained economist, now in the House of Lords, a principal in a family office, a sought-after board member, one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world, and an Oprah Winfrey's O Power list. You'd usually need a lineup of several guests to assemble all those accolades, but today we've got them rolled up into one person. Baroness Dr. Dambisa Felicia Moy of Knightsbridge, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. I feel like I'm attending my funeral.
Well, you've already done more than most people do in their whole lives. You've been fabulously educated at multiple universities. You've held positions in public and private worlds. You appear happy to court controversy and argue why consensus is wrong. And you've written from development aid to Africa and why it isn't working to the economic vulnerability of the West, China's unambiguous ambition, why democracies are under threat, and how company boards can work more effectively. But you're particularly focused on at the moment is developed market economic growth and investment opportunities, which we're going to talk about. So we have a light menu this morning. I'd like to travel back to Lusaka, Zambia, first of all. Zambia, where I actually spent part of my honeymoon a very long time ago, rich in natural resources, landlocked, bordering Central and Southern Africa. It's had its share of political upheavals and trauma. What stands out from your childhood?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. What stands out from my childhood, just how fortunate I am. You're right, Zambia is landlocked. It's in, you know, we considered Southern Africa. I know some people, there's always an ongoing debate about whether it's Central or Southern Africa, but in Southern Africa, at the time of my sort of birth, but also being raised in Africa, was an incredibly unique spot. The country was in a very unique spot because unlike our neighbors, Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, which was Rhodesia, we were actually quite peaceful. We had a one-party state, very state-led economy, and a natural resource copper-led economy. And what that meant is that although our neighbors had a lot of turmoil and conflict, it was during the apartheid era in South Africa, by and large, I had a very happy childhood. Growing up in Zambia, was at primary, secondary university in Zambia, and really grateful to have the opportunity to be in a place that really wasn't that ideological. So I've been, we'll get to it, I'm sure, but I've been able to travel to over 80 countries around the world, rich, poor, democratic, non-democratic. And I feel very lucky to be able to go to the US and China and see how two different conflicting models of politics and economics can actually both have amazing outcomes and not be sort of wed to one thing. So
from chemistry at the University of Zambia to Washington, we talked about your MBA, your master's in public administration from Harvard, which is, I don't think we've had anybody with an MPA on this. That was from the John F. Kennedy School of Government, and your DPhil from St. Anthony's, Oxford. I mean, I paused and I thought, was that fueled by an insatiable appetite to learn or part of a master plan?
It's interesting. All my work, whether it's my books, my five books, my current work in the Lords, but also in investment, is always driven by the question of human progress and economic growth. How do we generate growth in a sustainable way? And to me, this is the question of our generation, of our era. How do we generate growth that is sustainable, but is also equitable? And I'm not a big believer in sort of a lot of these tax and spend type of programs or universal basic income programs. So fundamentally, how do we actually turbocharge economic growth, particularly as the world's population continues to grow at expense. So I know that, you know, reading my biography or looking back on my experiences, it may, to the untrained eye, look quite mishmash and sort of all over the place. But in my mind, everything really fits together. And whether it's my books, as I said, or my academic background, my work is always about trying to find answers to the real challenging questions regarding human progress and economic growth.
As I was thinking about this, I thought it might be quite helpful to understand your political framework, because you're made a conservative peer, as we said, Baroness Moyo, you know, with a life peerage. This year, I think I'm right in saying that more voters than ever in history will go to the polls.
Yes.
However we might define, you know, polls and voting, but I think that's half of the world election. And I'd like to understand what being a conservative means to you.
Quite frankly, not much. And I say that with humility. I do not believe in ideology. I think, if anything, I think it's the enemy of growth. I think it's the enemy of progress. So some people lean conservative. Obviously, my books, particularly The Critique of Aid to Africa, which is my first book, to many people was seen as quite in support of the private sector and probably against, and largely against, sort of large statist bureaucracies. So I can understand why people might have that view, but I think it's an unvarnished truth in my mind that I would like to think of myself as being much more sophisticated in thinking about these very complex issues. You know, on the other hand, if you ask me, or a lot of my social leanings, women's rights, being an immigrant, thinking about, you know, issues around race, I would skew left. And so there is this tension. I think for a lot of people, it might even be considered a frustration that they can't pin me into a particular box. I happen to serve as a conservative peer because it was a conservative prime minister who put me in the Lords, but I have not been an MP, for example, a member of parliament. I'm not being defensive about it. I think there are a lot of ideas that I subscribe to that are center-right in terms of government fiscus, in terms of how the importance of business and private sector and, you know, as a tool for innovation. But I really abhor labels because I think it actually puts us all at a disadvantage to try and solve some of the biggest challenges the world faces, aside from growth, but questions of inequality, questions of environment, issues around technology. So that would be my response.
And we're going to talk about some of those in growth and investment terms in a minute. But you, of course, you have occupied private and public sector positions. How do you assess where we are in what appears to be a very splintered world?
Yes. So I very recently, somebody asked me to give the world economy a grade. And I said, I thought it was a solid B. And that's because on the one hand, you know, one of the sort of juggernauts of the world economy, the United States, continues to, you know, move along. And I'm using very macro metrics here in terms of their growth, inflation coming down, you know, looking at the jobs numbers, et cetera. At a very superficial level, you can see that the economy seems to be doing well compared to what we thought it would be, where we thought it would be even a year ago, but also compared to other regions of the world. So I'll put the U.S. as probably being a large part of why we're in a B grade and not a C grade. 90% of the world's population lives in the emerging markets. And so looking at the emerging market statistics, that's when it starts to look quite worrying. A lot of the large emerging market economies are in quite challenged positions. If you look at the traditional BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, many of them are very, very weak growth, which is less than 3% per year. As you know, in order to double per capita incomes in a generation, which is 25 years, you need to be growing by at least 3% a year. Many of them are not. And I think it's fair to say that we have a period of at least the next 5 years of pretty weak growth.
But let's just talk about the fact that the U.S. stands as, someone says, a shining beacon, but at what cost? And you just mentioned debt. I mean, you know, to be growing as they are, running these deficits and accumulating debt to GDP numbers that are extraordinary and unthinkable for those of us who have been, you know, in this business for a long time. There's a price.
Yeah. So the Congressional Budget Office has been talking about this since 2016. They said, you know, by 2025, 2030, the U.S. government would struggle to even pay or support its entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So this has been a problem that absolutely before the pandemic hit in earnest was already on the radar. But you're right. You know, fundamentally, as economists or as business people, we look at these numbers and say this is just not viable. And I think it's made more complicated by the political challenges, the fact that much of the debt is held by foreign lenders such as China, who, you know, we're basically publicly offside with in terms of public policy and politics. So it is a challenged position. That said, the U.S. dollar remains the reserve currency. And someone told me many years ago, I think it might have been Paul Collier, who was my doctoral supervisor, that basically, as long as somebody's willing to lend to you, the debt doesn't really matter. And he didn't say it as pointedly as I just put it to you, but that's essentially this argument that as long as there's no other game in town and investors are always thinking about where can I generate a return with relatively less risk, the U.S. is going to continue to look attractive. Look at the returns that the U.S. continues to generate. The United States is in a completely different space in terms of technology and pharmaceuticals. They are leading in those areas. But I think there's something to say that for there being a private sector that is vibrant and energetic, that acts as a counterbalance, and maybe counterbalance is not exactly the right term, but certainly sort of blunts the blow of what a debt crisis might look like in the United States.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description. So given this sluggish, almost at best, growth profile that we're looking at, what would be the two or three things you would really want policymakers to adopt?
So it really depends where you are.
Understood.
Shall we start in the UK? Because yes, we're in the UK and we can go beyond that. So to me, the biggest problem, and honestly, I'm going to sound like I'm stating something that's very obvious, but there is a real problem regarding bureaucracy and regulation. And the fact that UK pension funds in particular, whose exposure into the stock market in the UK, as we know, has gone from 32% in 1992 down to 1.6% in 2022, is a telltale signal. And yes, some people say, oh no, it's more complicated than it looks. But the fact of the matter is that if we cannot get institutional investors in the United Kingdom to invest in the UK stock market, we're not going to get anybody. I do believe a lot of that is regulatory red tape. Sure, there's been uncertainty. We've had multiple prime ministers. We've had Brexit. We've had pandemic. I get all of that. But at some point, it has to be a destination. The UK has to be a destination that investors look at as being competitive in terms of returns. As you know, the UK, there's a study, I think it was UBS study, that has the UK trading at a 40% discount to the rest of the world. I would just say that if you don't have regulation that actually encourages investment, we're going to continue to suffer the low growth and low investment statistics that I've just outlined.
Yeah, and we had a dinner with Peter Harrison and 20 of the UK's large allocators, as we do around our podcast universe, and what various constituencies are trying to do to, you know, reverse and, you know, really encourage that. But that's the UK. Europe's, you know, one says one shouldn't compare downwards, but eurosclerosis continues to be, you know, appeared to be a structural problem for Europe. So let's just migrate to Europe. You know, it's difficult because we've got different countries still running different, you know.
So let's just pick a couple of the, sort of the bigger ones. So let's say France, for example. I think I actually, you know, talking to, you know, as an LP in a number of the large venture funds in the tech space, the story coming out of France is much more constructive, oddly enough, you know, which is quite infuriating, I must say, because you sit in London, you say, well, how is it possible that France is, you know, they've got Choose France, they've got these big programs, and they seem to be working. People actually are looking at France. They think that there are real opportunities, certainly in the technology space. That's obviously a microcosm of the broader economic challenges, which we're all very familiar with. Very quickly, if I could just bring Germany into it. Germany, I think, is an example of how a handful of bad decisions can actually show up a generation later in a very, very damaging way to an economy. So, again, no need to relate the whole story, but we know this was an important economy in Europe, in the world, that has ended up, you know, exposed on the energy side, exposed in terms of the political environment, in a recessionary environment, largely driven by, I think, badly chosen trade-offs in terms of their trade-offs in automation, as one example. So these things are all can be remedied, but it does take a lot of challenge. And unfortunately, politics can sometimes overrun it. We are hearing out of Germany now a lot of right-wing activism coming in. Notion of immigration seemed like a good idea in a very narrow window of time. But in the broader scheme, clearly there's a lot more problems that have emerged in that country.
Yeah, and question marks certainly over Merkel's legacy that will be debated. But let's turn to China, because on the one hand, the world's pivoted, clearly because of the political positioning that, you know, shouldn't surprise anybody, but that China has. And also because in the race for resource capture, and you are very familiar with that, China has been unambiguously single-minded. And for my wife's birthday a couple of years ago, we were in Uganda, where she wanted to see the gorillas. We descended down to central Uganda and was amazed to see these roads being built and Chinese managers overseeing all this. And we know that China has stolen a march on the West for all sorts of reasons. Let's talk first about, before we get onto the commodity grab, let's talk about China and how you think it unfolds in terms of its growth.
I would say, first of all, the commodities story is so last season, as they say in the fashion industry. The China story remains quite challenged by a number of immediate problems, including debt, particularly in the real estate sector. They are now facing what we used to call back in the day what a middle income trap. And I think some would say worse than that, because they've still got a very large population that is some, in many cases, underemployed, unemployed, and suffering large amounts of debt. So it's a very complicated picture. The Chinese political class has been quite slow to implement a lot of the stimulus-type programs that people have been waiting for and expecting. The country's been facing deflation. And by the way, I'm focusing here on the things that are endogenous to China. So I'm not even getting into the regulatory clashes with the United States and what that has meant for capital investment from institutional investors in particular from outside of China. I'm just talking about their own choices and decision-making. As I pointed out a moment ago, the demographics are quite unfavorable. And it's hard to change those in a largely homogenous society. If you look at Brookings reports and other statistics about where the population could be at the end of the century, they're talking about it being around 800 million, maybe even lower, from 1.4 billion. So these are the challenges that China has to navigate.
So I want to come back, because you said the commodity story is, you know, is an old story. I'm not sure I agree with you, because here we have the energy transition that needs the rare earth elements. They're sitting in China, and we know that's going to be one of the levers in the chips versus rare earth elements. We've got the energy transition that is going to require uranium, and we've got, you know, Russia's interests, you know, sitting there, and we have shortages of all sorts of the sulfuric acid that, you know, is required. And then we have the Ukraine rebuild at some time is going to suck copper out of every area. So isn't there actually an argument that the commodities and the commodity cycle, albeit made up of different colors, is about to become extremely important?
Yes, you're absolutely right. However, when you said the China commodity story, my interpretation was very much the idea that China was going out to Brazil, across Africa, doing these negotiated trades, you know, with where no one who looks at utility functions and cost of capital could ever understand why they were overpaying for these assets. I'm saying that story's over. The rare earth story is interesting, but it's quite different in my mind because China actually produces rare earths. It's one of the leading countries in rare earths. And so it's no longer them going out to try and, you know, secure resources. And you're right, there are other resources like uranium, et cetera, lithium, where they will continue to be out there, so to speak. But I think that the narrative and the way that the commodity story emerges has changed. And I think that's what I was getting at. And yourself mentioned that the colors have changed. And I think a big piece of that story is that China is less likely and seems less likely to just go around the world and writing these big checks. I think that narrative to me is sort of a bygone one.
Got it. And we had a fascinating interview on our curated channel with Brian Mennell, who runs TechMet, which is one of these organizations that is focused on extracting those metals and elements required for the energy transition. And his point, which I think he makes very succinctly, is that essentially the West didn't realize there's a war being fought that they should have started 20 years ago, and that the West's ability to extract lots of these is a real challenge if the energy transition is going to take place.
I think that's right. And I think it is very sort of insightful to recognize that it's been going on for some time. There was a wonderful interview with the CEO, Gesslinger, I think is how he says his name, of Intel. And he was talking about how the United States, just in semiconductors, was one of the, I think certainly 30% of the market, somewhere 29, 30% of the market. It's now, you know, at best numbers in the, you know, in the low teens, some people say lower than that. And the reason I bring that up is that for whatever reason, the conflicts of factors, some might say it was arrogance, some might say it's lack of understanding competition, whatever the reasoning, we've ended up in a situation where China has become a major competitor in the semiconductor and the technology space and has leapfrogged many of the investments we'd have thought would be coming out of the United States.
So that leads us right into the asset allocation investment opportunity equation. You've been very focused on the structural shifts that could be the basis for outsized returns. How are you thinking about the investment opportunities that are getting your attention?
So I loved your interview with Manny Roman, who I've known for 25 years. And I think tell me if I'm wrong, but I think his main point, and is somebody who runs PIMCO, large fixed income, essentially an annuity investment. So anything to do with private bonds, corporate bonds, et cetera, that's his space, fixed income, et cetera, real estate. But it's pretty hard to get people off their perch when you have over 5% returns. Essentially, what is risk-free, ostensibly risk-free? I mean, we talked about the U.S. debts and deficits and how that might be a challenge. But I think Manny's absolutely right. I mean, why do I need to go to an emerging market or even a developed economy that outside the United States and take on the risk, political risk, societal instability, that where I might get similar returns for just bunging it into some kind of laddered structure in bonds? You know, I hear people juicing through private credit schemes and private finance and thinking about these multi-asset managers. I haven't gotten excited yet about moving money into those spaces. And look, other people have different views, but I just think it's a high hurdle given where rates are trading today.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is now sponsored by the World Gold Council. Gold has been at the foundation of human civilizations and economic history, from the pharaohs of ancient Egypt to James Bond, through to its vital role in central bank reserves. Gold has come to symbolize trade, culture, and currency. Discover the transformational powers of gold by watching Idris Elba's film on an adventure that explores gold's meaning and contribution to societies and economies the world over. Visit journey.gold on your browser to learn more. So I absolutely understand that. But of course, in the end, the beauty of the equity class is it's the proxy for GDP growth. Okay. And you're only ever earning an income stream off your bonds, and you are a potential victim to the erosion of purchasing power that is unmovable as far as governments who can print their own currencies. So how do you think, we've touched on the fact that there are tracts of Europe and the whole of the UK almost that is, you know, cheap, and, you know, there is a pendulum that swings, you know, in time. How are you thinking about the world of listed equities as opposed to private market?
Yeah, so listed equities, and I will give you a specific example, and I think I can tell this story. Yeah, I can probably tell the story without getting sued.
Well, that's good.
I served on the board of Barclays Bank for the full 9-year term. He joined that board in 2010. And by the way, I'm giving this example. It's quite emblematic of what I think the tensions are around where to invest and how to think about investment. And I should start off by saying that I generally think there's a home bias right now with a lot of people thinking about investing in the United States for obvious reasons. It doesn't really work as a home bias in the UK because we already talked about pension funds not investing in the UK. But put all that to one side. I was on the board of Barclays Bank. When I joined the board in 2010, the share price was around £3.50. It had been as high as £7.50. And today it's trading at around £1.60. So you've had 20 years of what just from that one stock is seen as value destruction. And I'm not here to say short Barclays. I'm not saying that at all. I think that it has a very important role in the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think it's quite hard to ask people to put their marginal dollars in an economy where the returns are, public returns are being, and by the way, they're just multiples, are far away from the multiples you can get in a place like the United States. And, you know, you made the point about equities essentially being a sort of shorthand for GDP growth. I think that's true in the U.S. for certain stocks.
You're right. The technology landscape in Europe is largely absent. Yeah, SAP and maybe LSEG now and a few others. But you've been focused on a couple of things, you know, technology, AI, and the energy transition. Isn't there an argument that actually some of the older companies in the world are going to be the big beneficiaries of this next revolution in technology? And that therefore, beyond the headlines of NVIDIA's valuation, which makes absolutely no sense to me on a sustainable basis, is that there are a lot, because we've had this bifurcation in the market, an extremely narrow market in the US, which typically, you know, isn't a healthy sign. Isn't there an argument that you want to be looking at the stuff that people care less about because they're the ones that can adopt these technologies and have the most meaningful transitions?
There is that argument, and I actually subscribe to that argument in large part in this particular sense. I'm not a big believer in the big headline numbers. Oh, generative AI is going to add $4 trillion, you know, value and profits. I think McKinsey's put out reports, Goldman Sachs put a report. I think there's, with these type of things, it always comes, it shows up, but it will show up later than people expect. And in my boardrooms, we talk about this a lot. The question is, how is the AI going to be adopted? And it's not just, oh, is it going to increase my top line revenue or reduce my costs? It's also about business models. So I think if companies can actually change their business models, and they will, if they, and think about changing their business models vis-a-vis AI, that becomes interesting. And, you know, let me just give you a very superficial example. I'm going back to venture capital, but the whole business model of venture capital is raise a lot of money, get basically invest the capital. Those startup businesses are going to hire 100 people and they're going to come up with something that actually turn out to be a winner. Fantastic. In an AI world, we might not need that many people. What does the business model look like in a world of AI? But that is the question we all need to ask in all our businesses. Is it the case that productivity gains will be so enormous that we might not need as many people? That's kind of been debated to death. But what about the tax regime? If you end up moving a company from having 100 employees to one employee and all the capital gains are accrued to the owners of capital, what does that mean fundamentally for society or for how business is run? you have fewer workers, but you have a bigger tax base. So I think these are all questions that are open-minded. And to your question about public listed companies, I think these are winner-take-all types of opportunities. And so I am looking at different businesses. Who are the leaders? How are they thinking about business model changes, not just superficial changes that could emerge out of AI.
So when we come back to the energy transition, lots of forces at work. We had CPP on from Canada, and we were talking about the fact that as some banks, Barclays is one of them, and they're choosing not to invest, you know, in legacy energy companies. At the same time, we all need to do the stuff that we do with, courtesy of, fossil fuels, is that you've got some areas that are proving to be less investable for some, and you've got energy transition with a lot of opportunity, but also a lot of uncertainty. How are you thinking about that space, given that you are advising and investing?
Well, so I'm glad you're asking me this question when we've had inflation and the price of capital is now 5% and a bit, because a number of years ago when cost of capital was basically zero, my answer might have been different. And we know that people were very enthusiastically throwing a bunch of ideas to the wall, everything from solar, wind, geothermal, biofuels, nuclear. I mean, there's a whole list of things that were potentially viable as alternative energy sources in a world where the capital was cheap. But nothing sharpens the mind, investment mind, than the cost of capital. And now I think we're actually seeing much more interesting proposals emerge, interesting in that they're viable and interesting in that they're scalable. So it's not just the cost question, but also about being able to roll these things out in a sustainable and scalable way. And I think there was too much talk about ESG, but also specifically around climate change that might not have fully reflected the challenge of a transition. A lot of the times, it's not about the production of the energy itself. It's about the distribution. How do you get this energy across the world? But there's no doubt about it that there are opportunities, whether it's nuclear Gen 4 type of innovations that are providing opportunities, even at the cost of capital where we are. So I do think because this is so fundamental, this is going to be an area for future investment. I would also like to just to say, and in here I do have a dog in the fight because I am an energy board. I tend to look at people like Warren Buffett. These are long-term thinkers who don't seem to me to have to be encumbered by by a lot of the sort of emotional aspects of the markets. He's at an age where people respect him, et cetera. And just look at his portfolio. He has energy companies, a large proportion of energy companies, and he did obviously very well in 2022. I'm talking about traditional, conventional energy companies. And when you add, and whether it's Occidental, he has exposure in Chevron. When you ask yourself, what is it that he knows or he sees that the rest of us are not seeing? I think there's a couple of things. First of all, it's a real understanding that this is a transition. I think we're more aligned on that now in the world. But he understood it was going to be complicated, that there's a large population, 8 billion people need energy, about 1.25 billion don't have access to energy in a clean, sustainable way. So he understood the market aspects of it. But I think he also understood that when the energy markets, which were about 20% of the S&P or mini indices, came down to around 2%, people were selling. He understood that the technologies required, the technologies and the public policy levers to move us into a new energy regime were going to be complicated. And that's why he basically doubled down on that sector. We'll never be able to get through the whole list of consequences of those types of choices. 30 years from now, we'll be saying, look at the inequality in the world, because people like Warren Buffett have had the foresight and have done the work very sensibly and with cool towel on their heads to realize that energy transition is going to be longer, it's going to be much more complicated, it's going to cost a lot. And I think selling out of these positions was very short-sighted. And actually, I've been quite an advocate of trying to get people to understand that there's a way to do the energy transition in a smart way that is going to be reduces cost and actually makes it more sustainable. So.
Look, I think obviously we're on the same side here, and that was one of the reasons why we did this interview with BP. But you sit on an energy company's board. What do you learn and absorb from that experience, as well as what do you think you give them?
So what do I learn and absorb? Creating energy is very difficult. Putting carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen together in a particular way to create energy and then to distribute it across the world in a sustainable way that I just walk into a room and I touch a light switch and the lights come on. It's something that a lot of people don't think about. I actually would say what I've just said for most global companies. People say to me, you talk about corporate governance. You know, there's so many bad companies out there. And I think to myself, think about how we live today. We can order a pair of trainers online and it miraculously shows up on Amazon Prime the next day, you know, for a de minimis cost, really, if you think about it. I mean, I was on the board of SAB Miller. I could order in London, a bar in London, a Mexican beer. And it would be, at that time, £3. I'm sure now it's much more, but £3. And I would think to myself, how did this get here? These companies, sure, we have bad actors, but by and large, you've got great companies doing great things. And going back to the energy question in particular, it is hard to make energy, to distribute it in a sustainable way. These companies, not just the one I serve on, but in general, people working in the space are diligent, they're working hard, they're working smart, they understand the challenges, and they're trying to get better all the time. And I think, again, going back to the Warren Buffett point, Warren Buffett understands that creating energy is difficult, but also understands that these businesses, who better to come up with the answer to the energy challenge than the people who actually understand what is required to distribute energy. And so to me, I absolutely think these energy companies are a buy, and it was made easier by the fact that they've traded down so much. I mean, even the ones in the UK, but also across the world, and that it's such a no-brainer. We've got 1.5 billion people who've got no access to energy. We still have an enormous amount of demand. If you look at the IEA and some of their forecasts on how much money needs to be pumped in, we're talking 50, multiple trillions of dollars to be pumped in to move this transition. I think understanding those basic facts, I think, is very very much a buy signal for me for energy companies.
And it was actually Schneider in France that was saying that the one of the ramifications of AI is, in fact, that the demand for electricity might be a multiple of what people are estimating. And it was, I think, another commentator who said, we're going to look back in 10 years' time and go, what do we miss? You know, just about so.
And crypto, by the way.
Oh, my gosh. No, we're not going to go there. No, but in the investing landscape, because I want to talk about boards in a minute, but anything else that sits there in the universe of investments that's getting your attention? I know you sit on the Oxford University Endowment Board with Sandra, who's been a terrific friend of the show and a guest. Anything that's getting your attention?
For macro traders, it's definitely an interesting time. And, you know, I'm actually delivering a speech at the Investment to International Capital Markets Association, looking at what is the challenge for the marketplace if rates start to go down. Are we going to start fueling new bubbles? How do we think about the investment responsibility of regulators, but also how are investors themselves thinking about the trajectory of rates? We started off this year with thinking they're going to be 4. I go to Jackson Hole for the Fed meeting every year and the last 15 years. And it's very interesting just hearing this tug of war between what the Fed is saying and how the markets are interpreting it. I think that the path probably down, although Larry Summers thinks we could have an up. But I think the market's way too optimistic about, way too optimistic about where we land, certainly this year, and when the rate cuts will show up. So that's the only other thing I would say.
You've written this book about boards, and I wonder what the key takeaways for you were, as much as what boards shouldn't do as what they should do.
So I'll start with what they shouldn't do. They shouldn't be complacent. And I mean that in a sort of very fundamental way. So the role of the board is enshrined in legalese, whether it's a company's house or a Delaware LLC. We have a very specific role that is actually, which has traditionally put financial shareholders at the top. And that's obviously changed with a lot of debate. But fundamentally, we have a legal responsibility. But I think the legal responsibility need not hamstring us into just doing what the legal wording says we're supposed to do. We have to be much more innovative about what that role of the board is. And I talk about this, and you know, traditionally it's been really about selecting the CEO and thinking about the company strategy. But really, in the last 10 years, we've been much more focused on what's shorthanded as ESG, but really thinking about what is the responsibility of an organization in a community with other competing stakeholders, public policy and regulators who give you the license to trade, but also the community of workers, community of suppliers, et cetera. So I think that's what I would say we should not do. Don't just say, well, this is what the legal says my job is. It's not that anymore. We have to think much more broadly. And I think that that's a good reason, a reason that we've seen the change in the makeup of boards over the last several years. When I joined my first board now almost 15 years ago, it was very much, I was a non-conventional board member because I had not been a CEO or a CIO or a CFO. And basically, put another way, the majority of people had been operators of businesses. That's changed because if you look across the world right now and think about what the biggest challenges are to companies, they're around technology, they're around pandemic response, they're around societal issues and societal changes. We talked a little bit about what might the tax base be if it turns out that AI does get rid of a lot of jobs. You know, all of these things mean that we can't just have, you know, traditional operators, although they still, I do think, should occupy a large proportion of the board. We now need to imbue those boards with people who have academic backgrounds or people who are scientists or working in different fields like defense. And I think that's what's happened in terms of what we should be doing and versus what we shouldn't be doing at the board level.
So, Debisa, I'd like to turn to a few general questions. You sit in the House of Lords. You had some heated exchange at one point with Bill Gates. I wondered how you think, given that this division at a geopolitical level, and I'm not talking across continents, I'm talking within countries, the US perhaps being the prime example. I mean, the irony is in the UK, the political divide has actually narrowed, you know, in the last few years. How do we turn down the heat of political exchange?
Pragmatism, I think. I think the problem is there are a lot of metrics and hand-waving. I mean, one of my very good friends is the chairman of Starbucks and the board of J.P. Morgan, Melody Hobson. She always says the numbers don't lie. And I think it's really important because very often, even in the Lords, I hear people come up with what I would sometimes call cockamamie proposals. And I think to myself, how can they think this? And then I realize that perhaps, you know, they're brilliant in their lane, but they haven't really understood just how dire the economic picture may be. Now, one thing that the U.S. has that I'm afraid many other countries don't have is quite a deep bench on the business side. So, sure, they can have their political chaos, but because it's a bottom-up society and because they've got such a deep bench in the business space, there's always this sense that their troubles are backstopped. Or at least this is my hope. I mean, they have had a civil war before, so hopefully that I'm right and it will not get worse. But you know, put another way, even if there's chaos at the political level, people can still point to 10 people who are investing in energy and AI in the tech space and who are really business leaders, whether it's Elon Musk or Bill Gates, you mentioned, you know, there are many people who are investing in these areas and doing actually great work with output. That's quite important. I think the big risk in other countries, which I'm going to shorthand as being top down, is that the government role is outsized.
Right. So three closing questions. There's that great book, If You Could Tell Us Just One Thing, so advice for people of all ages. What would be your piece of advice?
I would say no doesn't mean never. It just means not now. So I think too often, especially young people, somebody says no and they act like it's the end of the world. I've been there. But actually, just because somebody said no doesn't mean it's never going to happen. It just means you probably need to do a bit more work to figure out what will make it more likely to happen. So doesn't mean never, it means not now.
Great. And that, of course, does beg another question, is when one meets, if not failure, disappointment, and one has to just dig deep, how have you responded and how have you used your resilience? What advice comes from that?
Well, I think it's related to what I said a moment ago. I think too often people think of it as disappointment or failure as fatal. And I think one of the attractions of the American environment is that there is this sort of thing, is that the failure is actually part of the learning process. You know, by actually paying money or time or mind share into a project that doesn't work, you get information about what doesn't work. And in my small microcosm of the world, I at one point wanted to start a hedge fund. I got a license from the FCA, you know, paid my £5,000 for the license back in the day, started looking to hire traders, et cetera. And had I not done that, it didn't work, just to be clear, but had I not done that, I wouldn't have ever known why it didn't work. I now can tell you exactly why I wasn't able to build a, you know, multi-billion pound hedge fund. But if I had sat at home and decided not to pursue that, I would never have been able to really understand where the pitfalls or the hurdles would have been to try and build that sort of a business. So I think failure should never be seen as a sort of end game. It should really be as providing new information or more information that could be very helpful.
Yeah, and I think Europeans and the UK stigmatize failure in a way that doesn't happen in the US, and that is absolutely an obstacle. What was the lesson? Why didn't the hedge fund take off?
Really, it's a principal agent problem, which we don't have time to get into here, but it was very interesting. A number of hedge fund traders that I was interested in at that time, I would have loved them to take equity. They were interested in getting paid dollars up front, or pounds, as the case was at that time. And it is a principal agent problem, the old age principal agent problem, which is that they were very happy to, essentially it's about time horizons. They were much more short term. I'm going to be sure that I'm getting paid on a monthly basis. Of course, we've got costs and we have to live, et cetera. But I was much more skewed to building a business, which is much longer term. And so it was very instructive for me to understand that.
Absolutely. Final question is, we actually support 11 universities, finance societies right now. And so lots of young listeners. What advice for young people thinking about careers in finance?
It's honestly the best thing I ever did. I spent 10 years working at Goldman Sachs and then 9 years on the board of Barclays Bank and now working in investment. I absolutely love it. I think it is, you think of it as essentially road testing your views. And, you know, you can be long, you can be short, you could be neutral, but I think we're very prone to having strong views on different things in life. But this is on, you know, really getting to grips with how businesses work. How do they fit into the global economy? How do we think about these big trends? Are they materially going to change things? Or as Morgan Housel says, it's just same as ever. Things don't fundamentally change. And I think sports maybe is another area where it's really, it's in your face. It's very pointed. This question of, are you right or are you wrong? There's no hiding. My former boss, Jim O'Neill at Goldman Sachs, used to say the thing about sports is that you can't hide. If you cannot kick a free kick at penalty stage, there's no escape. It's just you and you have to do it. And I think that that's how finance is as well.
Yeah, that's right. Dambisa, I'd really look forward to this conversation. I'd listen to you talk at the LSE as part of my research. I'd read a number of your materials. You've had these great books out there as well that we'll put on our show notes for our listeners.
Thank you.
And we always take away a few things. I've written down quite a lot of things, actually, but I'm just going to say two of them, which is we think about investing and the danger for all investors. You get caught in the current emotion. And you said about Buffett, he doesn't have some of that emotional, you didn't use the word baggage, but that's essentially what you're saying. He's not encumbered by some of that stuff as he thinks about the energy companies, or indeed as he bought his stake in the railroads 20 years ago. You know, you have to understand how these things may pan out on a longer term view. And I think our industry is bedeviled by short termism. So I thought your point there was very good. And I also took that point that the US has deep entrepreneurial and corporate expertise, a deep bench of that. So it's making you, I think, a little more optimistic that whatever the political outcomes of this year of elections, and particularly we're now talking about the US, is there's this wealth of business talent that is, after all, what makes or society, capitalist societies, succeed or fail. So it's been absolutely terrific.
Thank you so much
for being here.
Thank you for hosting me. I've been absolutely thrilled to be here. Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.